We don't quite have a quorum. Julie, do you have a quorum of the... Okay. All right. Well, very good. Janice, do we have a quorum of the commission?
We do have a quorum with Commissioner Wirth. Right.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to call the MTC Planning Committee to order. I'd like to ask the vice chair or the chairman of ABAG if he'll call the ABAG Administrative Committee to order.
Thank you, and I will call us to order.
Okay, thank you. You know, first item is confirm that we have a quorum, and we do have a quorum. The we have an announcement to be read by the clerk, Janice.
As authorized by state law, I'm making the following announcement. Each member of the board here today will be entitled to receive $100 per meeting attended, up to a maximum of $500 per month per agency. This amount is provided as a result of convening a meeting for which each member is entitled to collect such amount. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the ABAG Administrative Committee, a similar announcement must be read.
Okay.
So for the ABAG Administrative Committee, pursuant to state law, the attendance at the meeting of the Administrative Committee of the following four members constitutes a quorum of a subsequently meeting body for which they will be entitled to receive compensation. Those committee members are Mayor Mark Green, Supervisor Scott Haggerty, Supervisor Sam Licardo, when and if he shows up, and Supervisor James Sparing.
Thank you, Ken. First item on the Planning Committee is the approval of the consent calendar. This is the minutes of our March 9th meeting. Is there a motion?
So moved. Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor? No dissent? That motion passes unanimously. We'll move on now to the Bay Plan area. This is the draft transportation investment strategy. Doug, are you going to kick this off? And Alex is there giving you wing support?
That's it.
All right.
Doug Kinsey, MTC staff. As we well know, SB 375 requires integration of a land use and transportation elements that comprise the RTP SCS. Last month, the committees reviewed ABAG's...
Doug, can you try the other microphone? That one's breaking up.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
That's that... much better. Yeah. I should have had you continue to use that. We'll get more support for the new building.
Yeah.
With a new PA system.
Okay. So last month you reviewed ABAG's draft preferred jobs, housing, connection, land use scenario, and today you're reviewing and we will be commenting on the draft preferred investment strategy. We made some minor revisions to your PowerPoint presentation that was included in your packet. You have a revised version in front of you, which I'll be talking off of. So the Plan Bay Area process has started officially about 2 years ago with a kickoff meeting with the One Bay Area Local Government Summit in April. So it's been almost exactly 2 years. So since that time, we've had two sets of workshops in each county, two telephone polls, several focus groups, targeted community-based organization meetings, and regular meetings with our advisory, partner, and stakeholder groups. So this slide shows some of the themes, the more prevalent themes that we've heard from each of these outreach efforts. First and foremost, we heard that it's imperative that land use policies and transportation investments encourage and sustain a healthy economy. I mean, we hear that over and over, and it is the most important issue, I think, that we've heard, or theme that we've heard so far. We've also heard that increased housing density is supported as long as it supports, again, a healthy economy and provides for more transit and protects open space. Third, we've heard that transportation expansion and road maintenance are the most important to the public through our surveys and focus groups. And many stated that land use policies and transportation investments should be the prime movers for reducing travel and greenhouse gas emissions. And then lastly, there was large support for making transit more efficient and more affordable. So our responses to the themes are basically summarized in this slide. The proposed investments support transit O&M and expansion in established communities and job centers, primarily the priority development areas. Through OBAG, we reward jurisdictions that build more housing. Third, Fix It First remains the Commission's top priority. Fourth, the plan furthers Resolution 34 delivery and identifies the next generation of new and small starts. And lastly, it embodies the transit sustainability project recommendations that you will be considering later this month. We've mostly reviewed this slide off and on for the last several months. I think this is just a variation of what you've seen before. Per SB 375, ARB set GHG emission targets of -7% per capita in 2020 and -15% in 2035 compared to 2005. We meet the 2020 target, but the land use element leaves about a 6% gap to fill for the 2035 target. The slide mentions a couple of things that I think are worth highlighting here. First is almost 90% of the plan's investment is maintaining our existing system. So that makes it difficult to move the GHG needle to some degree. But more importantly, while the O&M investment is not quantifiable for GHG emissions, it directly supports land use strategy and equity principles. Given that most of the existing transit serves the region's urban core, which also overlaps with priority development areas, low-income communities, and other communities of concern. This slide demonstrates why it's difficult for land use and transportation to move the GHG needle here in the Bay Area. This slide replaces the four slides that were included originally in your packet, but the gist remains the same. The Bay Area is projected to have relatively slow growth, and we have a very robust transportation system already in place. As a result, in 2035, the Bay Area's households will travel about 30% to 50% less than our large sister MPOs to get about the same 15% GHG reduction. And that the growth increment will need to travel about 75% less than existing Bay Area households to achieve the 2035 target. So you can see that's a pretty tough pull. I'll now turn your attention to the draft transportation investment strategies. Most of you have seen this slide as well. The plan revenues are estimated to be about $277 billion in total over the next 28 years. Of this amount, about 70% is committed revenue for existing plans and programs. 10% is conditioned discretionary funding, mostly directed to transit O&M. And the remaining 20%, or $56 billion, is for today's investment trade-off discussions. This slide shows the color of money for the $56 billion in trade-off funds. The flexible funds you see in the upper left-hand corner of the pie chart will support regional and local projects and programs. The other regional funds that are shown near the bottom will support lifeline and high-speed rail improvements. And the local sales tax rollover support local projects and programs. The draft investment plan includes six recommended strategies that we'll discuss and that we'll seek your feedback on today. They're rooted in the three E's, economy, equity, and environment, and provide the framework for the draft transportation investment plan. The slide shows that each of the investment strategies address at least two of the three E's. Our first strategy is focused exclusively on investments that our research has shown can best help us achieve or exceed the GHG emission reduction targets. Staff proposes to invest up to $700 million, or about 1% of the total trade-off funds, over the next 28 years on several programs designed to achieve the 6% GHG per capita gap reductions to achieve our 15% GHG reduction target in 2035. There are several other strategies included in our recommended investment plan, such as bike network expansion, safe routes to school, safe routes to transit, and others that are not listed here since their estimated impact on regional GHG reduction is relatively minimal. The next two slides describe two paths for generating the additional 6% GHG per capita reduction. Option A emphasizes cleaner vehicles and reduced driving strategies. It also includes several programs that are designed to accelerate the penetration of cleaner vehicles into the Bay Area's car and light truck fleet. Our research has shown that greening of the fleet is one of the most effective near-term GHG reduction strategies that we can implement. And to that end, the Air District and MTC have already approved allocations for a combined about $18 million in our first cycle STP CMAQ funds to accelerate electric vehicle penetration into the region. Option B focuses more on getting GHG reductions through better utilization of our existing fleet. The 55-mile-an-hour speed limit on Bay Area freeways is our most effective strategy for reducing GHG emissions with a side benefit of saving lives. However, all of our surveys and workshops and the like have indicated that this is a very unpopular strategy. In addition, we have heard from our Policy Advisory Council that greening the fleet raises equity issues because lower auto ownership rates for lower-income residents, and that even with a subsidy provided, they would find it difficult to afford newer and cleaner vehicles. There are also suggestions to support transit subsidies for low-income residents. We understand that low-income residents may not be able to participate to the extent and the level as the higher-income residents, but remember our intent here is to identify strategies with the highest reductions of GHG emissions to meet our adopted targets. And remember that 90% of our recommended plan is for O&M, and in addition to that, 70% of total expenditures are for transit O&M and for transit expansion. And as mentioned previously, these investments largely support existing communities and communities of concern. So we'll be seeking your advice on which strategies to include, and based on your comments, in May we'll recommend a climate investment strategy designed to achieve an additional 6% or more GHG reduction. And lastly, in closing my part of this presentation, in May we'll also assess how the proposed RTP SCS meets the other performance measures, the adopted targets that ABAG and MTC have adopted. And then we'll also be looking at some of the equity targets in May as well. So today the focus has been mostly on GHG emission targets for this first strategy. But in presenting to you the final recommendation, draft preferred investment strategy and land use strategies, we'll present you a full complement of how we achieve adopted targets and also equity targets. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Alex to take you through the rest of the investment strategies.
Okay. Alex, before you get started, if anyone would like to speak on this item, please turn in your card, and I'd appreciate it if you get it in right away. We're on a kind of a tight schedule. We've got other meetings that follow, and so please get those speaker cards in. Thank you. With that, Alex.
Great, thank you. I will cover investment strategies 2 through 6, which, as Doug noted at the outset, represent about 99% of the $56 billion in trade-off revenues. Just a point of clarification, the pie chart at the lower right hand of each slide serves as a scorecard as I walk through the presentation on the investment of the trade-off revenues. So investment strategy 2 is the fix-it-first strategy, and the proposed approach would continue and improve on the investments to fix-it-first in Transportation 2035. Specifically, the proposal would fully fund transit operations at existing service levels, maintain the pavement condition for local streets and roads, fully fund the replacement of revenue vehicles and over 70% of the fixed guideway and track infrastructure, and invest in state and bridge rehab and retrofit. Even with the proposed investment of over $20 billion, representing about 43% of the trade-off revenue and nearly 90% of the total revenues for Plan Bay Area, this investment will still fall short of the Plan Bay Area targets. And as a reminder, the Plan Bay Area targets called for improving the pavement condition for the street network to 75. It currently hovers in the mid-60s. As well as the targets called for replacing all transit assets on schedule and reducing distressed state highway lane miles. This slide provides more context on the overall maintenance and regional needs and how much is being proposed to be funded, as well as how the regional investments compare to the last plan, Transportation 2035. The bar charts on the left show the total need by the various fix-it-first categories. The first bar for each category is the last plan and the identified needs from that plan, and the second shows you Plan Bay Area. The light blue is the committed revenue. The yellow is the proposed investment through the trade-off revenues, and the blue is the remaining need that would need to be spent to meet the performance target. Moving to the bars on the right, the yellow inset, this really zeroes in on the proposed regional investment for Fix It First. And it also compares this investment to Transportation 2035. As shown, the proposed investment of $10 billion for streets and roads, $2 billion for transit operations, $8 billion for transit rehab, and $1 billion for state highway and bridges are all increases over the proposed Fix It First investments in Transportation 2035. This next slide highlights the robustness of the fix-it-first investment strategy for Plan Bay Area as compared to other metropolitan areas in California. Most areas are investing around 50% of their revenues into fix-it-first, while the Plan Bay Area proposal includes 88% for fix-it-first once you consider all revenues. Moving to investment strategy number three, Plan Bay Area proposes to follow the One Bay Area grant investment framework. As a reminder, the One Bay Area framework rewards jurisdictions that produce housing near transit and seeks to create healthy, vibrant communities. This investment strategy supports multiple performance targets, most importantly, housing the region's proposed housing growth, the region's projected housing growth, but also reducing VMT, greenhouse gas emissions, and increasing non-auto mode share, and also increasing the average walking and biking times. The proposed investment is $14 billion, or about 26% of the trade-off investment pie. But as I will cover in a moment, this in part overlaps with the fix-it first investment in the local roadway network, and the overlap can be seen in the yellow hatched area. This slide shows the comparison of the last plan investment in several investment categories that used to be siloed. These investment categories include local streets and roads, TLC, bicycle and pedestrian improvements. And as you can see, in One Bay Area grant, these are all more flexible, and any level of investment can be used. And also, the One Bay Area grant proposal for Plan Bay Area increases the investment to these categories by about 40%, and again, makes it more flexible in terms of the specific investment. A fundamental element of this investment strategy and Plan Bay Area is to focus growth around transit and to ensure that a robust and multimodal transportation system is provided to support this growth. Investment strategy number four proposes to fund high performers, as was determined through the performance assessment, and also through an evaluation of the most promising transit candidates for the next generation of new starts. It also supports early high-speed rail on the Peninsula Corridor. The high performers through the performance evaluation, as a reminder, had strong benefit-cost ratios and strong performance target scores. A list of the specific projects is included in Appendix 3 if you'd like to look at the specific projects. The high performers support the economic performance target as well as greenhouse gas and VMT reduction targets. The proposed investment is $8 billion, or roughly 14% of the $56 billion in trade-off revenues. The region's transit expansion program, Resolution 3434, is over a decade old, and as shown by the green in the status column of this chart, over half of the projects are currently either open to the public or are currently in construction. Resolution 3434 not only set forth a vision for transit expansion in the region, but also has allowed the region to speak with one voice about its priorities and in advocating for limited dollars in Washington and Sacramento. The most significant source of funding is the federal New and Small Starts program. The two current New Starts projects that are part of 3434, the BART to Berryessa project and the Central Subway project, either have recently secured a full funding grant agreement in Washington, and in one case I think held their groundbreaking just yesterday, or are expected to get a full funding grant agreement within the next several months. In terms of Plan Bay Area, if we assume the region attracts a similar share of new and small starts as in the past over the life of the plan, there is roughly $2.5 billion in revenues after accounting for the two committed new starts, or we can call them big start projects. To tee up strong candidates for new and small starts in Plan Bay Area, staff conducted an evaluation of the existing Resolution 3434 projects, as well as high-performing projects against several criteria. The criteria included some of the same that were looked at in the performance evaluation, cost-benefit, as well as how well the project scored against the performance targets, but also looked at readiness, local match, TOD potential, equity targets, and regional connectivity. Five projects emerged the strongest through this evaluation. Two of the projects would be competitive for big starts, the extension of BART beyond Berryessa to San Jose and Santa Clara, and the extension of Caltrain downtown to the Transbay Transit Center. Three projects would be competitive for small starts based on their cost, and that would be the AC Transit, Bus Rapid Transit, the AC Transit Grand MacArthur BRT, as well as the San Francisco Van Ness BRT. The projects all had a benefit cost of over 4 and scored over 5 on the performance targets. In addition, the projects were generally either through the environmental process or expected to have environmental within the year. The equity targets and TOD potential were also strong for these projects. For Plan Bay Area, the five projects are proposed to be funded through a combination of committed funds, new and small starts, as well as future high-speed rail and local sources such as sales tax, new bridge tolls, joint development, and Santa Clara net express lane revenue. I mentioned that Plan Bay Area estimates $2.5 billion for new and small starts. This proposal would direct $1.8 billion to fully fund these projects and leave $660 million in reserve for future discussions and transit priorities. Many projects are currently in the planning stage and performed either high or at mid-level in the performance evaluation and should be part of an expanded discussion for additional new small starts funds. Lastly, on investment strategy number 4, Plan Bay Area proposes to recognize the recently approved Memorandum of Understanding that funds early investments on the Peninsula Corridor in support of California high-speed rail. The specific investments total $1.5 billion and include electrifying Caltrain and installing an advanced signal system on the corridor. Moving on to investment strategy number five, this strategy seeks to squeeze more efficiency out of our existing system through investments in three programs: a regional express lane network, a San Francisco pricing program, as well as the freeway performance initiative. These strategies improve management of the freeway, highway, and arterial network, will improve reliability, and charge drivers a fee in congested areas, then use those revenues to improve the overall transportation network. This strategy supports the region's economy as well as reduces VMT and greenhouse gas emissions. The proposed investment is $3 billion, although, again, there is some overlap between this investment strategy as well as the high performers, in that the Freeway Performance Initiative and the San Francisco pricing were high-performing projects. As a quick overview of the regional express lane network, the network is estimated to cover just under 300 miles, with over half of the miles being conversion lanes. The cost is estimated at $3.6 billion, with only $600 million proposed to come from trade-off revenues, with the remaining coming from toll revenues, from fees paid by the drivers. The regional network focuses on Interstate 80, Interstate 680, and Interstate 880, and complements express lanes already in operation and previously authorized on Interstate 580 and in Santa Clara County. Investment strategy number six, which is the final investment strategy, strives to make the transit system sustainable. It focuses on three areas: improving the finances of the existing transit system, improving service for the customer, and attracting more riders to the system. The proposal for the commission would establish specific performance measures, create an investment and incentive program, and make targeted institutional changes. This slide provides more detail on how the recommendations for the Transit Sustainability Project align with the three objectives, including requiring a 5% improvement in one of three performance metrics within 5 years. The Select Committee for Transit Sustainability forwarded the recommendations for approval at the May Commission meeting. In terms of trade-off investments, staff proposes including $500 million toward low-cost, high-impact improvements in major transit corridors, what we're calling the Transit Performance Initiative. The program could also reward agencies that achieve ridership and productivity gains. This strategy helps to achieve greenhouse gas emission reductions as well as VMT reductions, and also increases non-auto mode share. The county priorities are the final piece of the pie, making up 29% of the trade-off revenue investments. Like other areas of the investment picture, there's also overlap between the county priorities and earlier investments, in that the counties supported many of the high priority and other investments discussed earlier. Overall, the county proposals would direct half of their investments towards Fix It First, and within that, roughly equally to transit and to roadways. Similarly, for expansion, which they propose to invest roughly 34%, the modal split was roughly equivalent. And another 14% was proposed to support bicycle and pedestrian-type projects. So putting the entire trade-off pie together and slicing it in slightly a different way, we see that the majority of the $56 billion investment would go to support operations and maintenance of the existing system. at well over at 72% of the of this revenue, and roughly half would of the investment is directed to public transit, mostly to operation and maintenance, but also some to transit expansion. If we step way back and we consider all of the revenues in the plan, which is $277 billion, and that was the picture that Doug had introduced at the outset, we see that 88% of the funds are directed to operations and maintenance. So the pies that you see here, on the left is Transportation 2035, and on the right is Plan Bay Area. And as you can see, there's comparability between the investment in O&M between Transportation 2035 and Plan Bay Area, but Plan Bay Area does increase the investment in operations and maintenance. With that, I will turn it back to Doug to give you the final steps towards completion of Plan Bay Area.
Just as a wrap-up, as noted on your agenda, this is an information item today. The schedule overall is intended to give you and our stakeholders several opportunities to weigh in on this proposed investment and strategy and ABAG's land use plan as well. Next month, we would be asking for this joint committee's referral and approval of the transportation investment plan and the land use strategy at your May 11th meeting. And then there is a scheduled joint ABAG Executive Board and MTC commission meeting scheduled for May 17th in the evening to adopt the preferred investment strategy and the land use plan as well. That basically will set the stage for the environmental process we need to go through and the equity analysis we need to go through on the preferred strategy. The preferred investment strategy will, and land use plan will basically become the project that gets evaluated through the EIR process, and then we'll also be developing alternatives that we'll be evaluating over the next 6 months that also will be done at the same time as the equity analysis. And then, as shown on the slide, we will be releasing a draft plan and EIR toward the end of this year in December, and still scheduled to adopt the Plan Bay Area and certify the EIR in April of 2013. That concludes our presentation.
Okay, that's a lot of information. What I'd like to do, I have a fair number of speaker cards, so if commissioners or committee members have questions they would need to ask before the public comments, I'll do that, but I would like to take the public comments and bring it back to the committee or committee. Scott, did you?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I can wait.
Okay, all right, thank you. Linda Best, Linda? And after Linda will be Paul Campos.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Linda Best. I'm with the Contra Costa Council, and we are also a member of the Bay Area Business Coalition. And we have just recently submitted to your agencies to be distributed to all of you a letter requesting answers to several questions and a lot more information that we think is vitally important to our ability to evaluate the draft preferred scenario, which is under consideration now. We understand that it's important to move the process along and that the comments will be able to make comments on the draft preferred scenario going forward. However, once this plan draft is adopted, it has an elevated status, and when we met with your staff, they said, of course, that this is true. So we think it's extremely important that we get this information prior to the adoption of the draft preferred scenario and in advance, enough time in advance to be able to properly evaluate it and absorb the information and make further comment. So we request that this information be made available as soon as possible and certainly 30 days before the draft preferred scenario is adopted. And I think there'll be further members of the coalition who will talk about some of the questions that we have submitted. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Paul Campos and then Catherine Lyons.
Thank you all. Paul Campos with the BIA of the Bay Area. echoing Linda Best's request that and suggestion that this timetable is too aggressive for the ABAG and MTC full boards and commission to really make a fully informed decision on what should be the draft preferred land use scenario. You know, we spent, most of us, several years looking at three alternative scenarios. I'm not sure anyone really fully understood or understands to this day what the implications are for all of those in terms of each city and county, how much housing is expected to be in those under each scenario, and how, of what type and what density. And I think even less now is known about the jobs housing connection that staff is asking you to basically anoint as the preferred strategy in May. So I want to reiterate that we would very much like to have the answers to the questions that we submitted this week, along with the request for information. Quite frankly, it's information that has been asked for, and staff and the agencies have committed to provide as long ago as 2 years ago. For example, an assessment of each PDA. That process was begun, and there was supposed to be a final report talking about how ready each PDA is to develop, economic feasibility, what kind of public subsidies are required, how far along in the entitlement process they are. That hasn't been done. We also haven't seen an analysis of exactly what the implications are and differences between what's being prepared and the a trend scenario. What's currently in Transportation 2035 as compared to the draft scenario, using an apples-to-apples comparison in terms of jobs and population. So a lot of information that we respectfully request is necessary. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Catherine Lyons and then Rich Hedges.
Good morning. Catherine Lyons with the Bay Area Council, also a member of the Bay Area Business Coalition. Following up on what Linda Best and Paul Campos just said, you know, we do ask that the questions and the information that we submitted, we believe, first of all, that there are vital pieces of information that will help with the successful implementation of the SCS, and we ask that these questions be answered and information provided before calling this a draft preferred scenario and before the adoption of this scenario, which you just reported will be occurring next month. We believe this is too soon, considering the vital information that you all are presenting to us today, and we ask for more time to consider this information and the information we requested before the adoption. Thank you for your work on all this, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you. Rich Hedges and Tilly Chang.
Good morning. I want to talk about some specific issues outlined and the two investment options, A and B. And I think that the answer in getting to 2035 and our 15% reduction is really in the weeds. And there are some simple things I think we can do to give us a boost. One of them would be, for instance, automobile tire pressure. Most of us, I have for the last 4 years, always worked on my own car. Before that, taking my car to a dealer to have it serviced. I keep my tire pressure at 35, which is 5 above the handbook. If I don't tell them to leave it alone, they lower it to 30. That costs fuel. It's a safer ride at 35. You get longer tire wear. Usually I get 20 to 40,000 miles above the advertised mileage on my tires because of the way I drive. So simple things like mandating a change in a handbook, which is not an engineering feat for an automobile company. It's a printing issue. And the in-fuel meters, most cars have had those since around 2000, most new cars. The 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, I actually do that now. And in the Bay Area, that saves lives. It stops accidents that create congestion. It's a freer way. It's an easier way to more easily utilize the entire freeway network because it runs much smoother. It may be unpopular, but most of the people that pass me end up in the same line with me, and I've saved fuel when we get to the
to the bottlenecks caused by bad driving. And on top of that, with the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, you can open one lane in our express lane network for 65-mile-an-hour driving. This encourages people to use it. It raises funds. If you just give me 1 second. I support the electric car, but quite frankly, in our community, we've done the research trying to allow it in our units. It will trip the breakers with one car and make it impossible for 12 people to get out of their garages in the morning.
Okay.
So,
thanks,
I mean,
Rich.
And we're some of the newer units in the city. Also, if...
All right, wrap up, Rich.
Okay. Mr. Loring wanted me to tell you that there's actually a program that's very simple where you can do a battery exchange where it's charged. You can use current infrastructure for that.
Okay. Thank you, Rich. Tilly Chang. Tilly, before you get started, we have seating in the overflow room, and it has both video and audio. So if you want to sit down and listen to the conversation, you can do that in the other room. Thank you, Tilly.
Good morning, Chair Sparring, Committee Members Tilly Chang, San Francisco Transportation Authority. We would like to very much thank and appreciate the excellent staff work that has brought us to this review of a very strong preferred alternative, in our opinion. We especially want to thank the teams led by Doug, Alex, and Ken, who have worked so hard over the year, especially with the CMA planning directors, and I'll go ahead and thank them on behalf of my colleagues. Who may also do so themselves. But we do appreciate the inclusive process and performance-based process that we have undertaken for this first SCS RTP. We do, in San Francisco, strongly support the exciting new features of the plan, such as the One Bay Area Grant Program and the TPI, the Transit Performance Initiative. We consider these truly breakthrough initiatives and stand ready to help shape both so that they're workable and effective. Third, we are particularly excited about the proposed regional transit expansion priorities and wish to thank the Commission and our Executive Director for your leadership on building consensus in the region for the Bay Area High-Speed Rail and Caltrain investment strategy. We look forward to moving this important project forward with the rest of the state. On the reserve pot for new and small starts, we understand and support its inclusion and would only seek clarification on the process to access those funds. As our Geary BRT project and other projects in the region will be surely be ready and competitive for these funds in the near future. On the climate strategies, a note that we do wish to request clarification about the potential cost effectiveness and equity performance of one of the EV strategies on the adoption and program to accelerate consumer purchase of electric vehicles. And finally, we'd like to help with advocacy, legislative revenue advocacy, to help strengthen housing and job creation in the region and infrastructure funding overall. So thank you again. We look forward to the next steps.
Manuel Gonzalez Este. Manuel. And then Bob Allen. And then Lindsay Iam.
Good morning, Commissioners. Manolo Gonzalez Este, Transportation Policy Director for Transform. Late last night, you should have received in your email a letter giving you six strategies with also six recommendations. Understanding that you all have been working hard on this, it's an opportunity to get people out of cars and get people into walking communities and to look at these solutions. A couple of the strategies, I'm not going to go through all of them, wanted to focus on and make sure that you all focus on too, is funding the highest performers, BART Metro. This is something that will obviously help the community, help people move, and looking at it as a high performer, we want to make sure that you offer the full funding for that. The other thing we wanted to make sure is looking at the GHG levels, understanding that you have all seen SB 375, have embraced it in the past. It's something, however, though, that here is faltering, and we want to make sure that you revisit this and make sure. The last RTP drew strong support across the board for climate initiative grants. We want to make sure that you don't abandon those views and look at those and come back to make sure that we can meet our goals to reach that and not just give some of the solutions that are here. We are offering some other ideas in the recommendations that we have. Please look beyond what you have now to be able to do that. The last thing we want to make sure is on the express lanes. These are solutions to find, get people out of the cars, but also to get people more into vehicle miles traveled. But we also want to make sure that the expansions that you have far and beyond don't go to certain ones. We have it listed there which ones we want to make sure you have. If you have any questions, we have copies of the letters. Staff informed me that you do have received copies of that. Thank you, Supervisor Haggerty, for showing that. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bob Allen? Bob?
Good morning, Commissioners. Bob Allen from Urban Habitat. I want to thank the staff and the Commission for all their work on this process to date, a process that we know is predicated on more people living in denser, more compact neighborhoods served by robust transit that gives alternatives to driving and reduces greenhouse gas emissions. That's why we're all here working on this process. One thing many of us have been asking for, though, is to look at the impact of transit service cuts and how that, since 2008, since the recession particularly, and how that's impacting our future growth strategy, the SCS process, and impacts communities today that rely on public transit. Largely absent from that discussion, again, other than in the TSP process, where we have looked at declining service levels, metrics associated with that, and proposed cuts in operations cost growth, we haven't had that discussion about what it would cost to go back and restore the service that's been cut, which, again, I would think would be an important premise of this entire process. You all know from the headlines, you heard from your constituents, advocates like us, transit operators about the service cuts, fare increases, and job losses over the last couple of years. Secretary LaHood, DOT, just came out with record transit ridership numbers from February a year ago to today. We're on a, you know, an unprecedented kind of trend line in terms of transit growth, coupled with or driven by increasing gas prices. But we don't see a commensurate effort to look at how we're going to restore service. Although we're very, you know, supportive of initiatives like the TPI, which we think will help, especially in urban trunk lines and bus service, what we're concerned about is the relatively small investment. And the much we think is important is the larger investment to go back and restore that service. So I really come here today to say I think an important part of the, an ingredient in this whole conversation is some order of magnitude to look at what it would take to restore that service, particularly bus service, which is, you know, as you know, is a particular interest and advocacy goal of ours. It's a longstanding goal. So what we'd like to ask for the next meeting is to have agendized for next commission meeting to come back, look to staff to give you a sense of what it would cost to restore that lost service, which we think is essential, as well as an analysis of where funds could be shifted to meet that goal. It's okay. Something we've raised at the TSP, and we hope that staff can agendize that for the next meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Lindsay Hemai, and then Alejandra Sanchez.
Okay. Good morning, chairs and members of the ABAG and MTC commissions and boards. My name is Lindsay Hemai. I also work at Urban Habitat, and I'm also the co-chair of the Six Winds Network, which is a broad network of faith, environmental, social justice, and community groups from across the Bay Area. We partner very closely with community-based organizations from almost every county in the Bay Area, Sonoma, Contra Costa, Alameda, Marin, Santa Clara, San Francisco, and San Mateo. We've heard pretty clearly from folks that one of their top priorities is reliable, affordable transit to get them to their everyday needs. And that's why our top recommendation, as Bob mentioned, is really restoring lost service. We also are encouraged by the Transit Priority Initiative, which we think will help improve reliability on core urban bus lines, and that's a great step. But again, we think restoring lost service is critical. A complementary recommendation that we also wanted to put forward is that of prioritizing additional funds for lifeline transit that really fills gaps in the transit network supporting communities of concern. Lifeline, we've seen as been able to fill gaps, both fixed route transit, but also shuttles in places like East Palo Alto and the Monument Corridor in Concord. So specifically, some recommendations around Lifeline are, one, be sure to approve it in your next agenda item as one of the projects for inclusion. Increase funding and make sure it's really targeted to closing those gaps in the transit network. And finally, address one of the problems with Lifeline as it currently is. It's a three-year allotment. And so once a program actually gets its ridership, gets established, suddenly it has to go out and try to find funding again. And so we need to find a way to provide continuous funding for those projects like the shuttles and like the fixed route service that's so critical. We think this will be key to achieving our greenhouse gas emission targets and also some of the social equity targets, particularly the housing and transportation costs, which came out very poorly in the alternatives analysis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alejandra?
According to a study conducted by the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy, nearly 70% of the nation's workforce in metropolitan areas relies on public transit. Transit systems across the Bay Area are crucial not only to our workforce that utilizes its services, but also to the thousands of students that rely on public transportation to receive their education. My name is Alejandra Sanchez, and I am an Oakland resident and a graduating senior at UC Berkeley. I depend on AC Transit for everyday needs, but most importantly, for my commute to campus. 2 years ago, I was able to just take one bus from my apartment in Oakland to campus in Berkeley. But with recent changes to the bus routes, my one line has been split into two separate routes. Not only does this imply a longer commuting time, but it also increases the cost of transit fare. I am fortunate that as a Berkeley student, I am provided with a bus pass as an extension of my tuition. I appreciate the necessary arrangements that were made to afford us students this opportunity. However, the same privilege does not extend to the majority of transit passengers. The rerouting of bus lines, increasing commuting times, often unreliable schedules, are real burdens that are felt economically as well as temporally. These issues should be fully addressed before giving consideration to transit expansions. The livelihoods and education of transit riders depend on the consistency and maintenance of current routes. I urge the board to consider the impacts of transit system fund allocation on the communities that most utilize its services, to prioritize the maintenance and quality of the current bus routes and not on expansion. I urge you to prioritize even discretionary funds to return service to 2009 levels. Thank you for the opportunity.
Nisha, UC Berkeley student, Nisha, could you give us your last name when you get up there, if you would, please.
Hi, I'm Nagan Efisi. I'm a UC Berkeley student. And coming to Berkeley, I came from a suburban city where everyone has their own car because everything's spread out. But here, I was happy to be able to use public transit to go everywhere I needed to go. But I came to realize that it's not a very reliable system of transportation, which is unfortunate because we have the infrastructure and the funds to make it reliable, but it isn't. So I had to bring a car up here because I have a part-time job, and I know I'm just a student, but people that are working and have jobs, if AC Transit isn't reliable for them, then they don't necessarily have the economic means to afford their own car to be able to make sure that they get where they need to go on time. And also, I know a major purpose of everything you guys are doing is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and if you increase reliability, then more people can rely on the public transportation so they won't need their own vehicles, which do emit greenhouse gases. So I think you guys should prioritize funding for local bus services, even if it means discretionary funds. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Kimberly Willis and Amy Hill.
Good morning. My name is Kimberly Willis, and I'm a senior at UC Berkeley, studying environmental justice. And I wanted to weigh in today on behalf of transit-dependent communities. As a transit user, I have growing concerns over the future of our transit system. Low-income communities and communities of color are the primary users of transit systems in the Bay Area. It is important to prioritize the provision of services to these already disadvantaged communities to promote equity and access. We also need to prioritize funding for transit-dependent riders so that bus and BART services remain in areas that resist gentrification. If communities undergo gentrification, transit-dependent people will likely be pushed to the periphery, while transit operations suffer huge losses of the people who used to frequent their systems. Transit operations will suffer revenue losses, and transit-dependent people will have to spend more time and money getting to work, school, and other places of necessity. Without access to transit, many low-income households will choose to purchase a car, likely a car with poor gas mileage. This will not only put an increased financial burden on already stretched family budgets, but will contribute to greenhouse gas emissions created by automobile traffic in the Bay Area. American cars and pickup trucks are responsible for nearly half of the greenhouse gases emitted by automobiles globally. I urge you to prioritize funding to transit-dependent communities in the Bay Area and to promote equity, increase access, and prevent more cars from contributing to greenhouse gas emissions on the roads. You can do this by restoring public transit services to 2009 levels. Thank you.
Thank you. Amy, and then Scott Peterson.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. My name is Amy Petray Hill. I'm with the Unitarian Universalist Legislative Ministry of California, and I'm here today to speak on the over 20 congregations in all of the nine counties of the Bay Area. And we're here basically because as communities of faith, we're concerned about the low-income individuals who are expected by 2040 to pay something like 84% of their income for housing and transit. And while there's lots of positive things in the investment strategy, I just wanted to bring up two possible areas of concern. One around electric cars. Electric cars are wonderful, but I echo the sentiments of other people that are concerned that this may not really address all of the needs of the whole community. So getting more specific information on how that will affect equity and ability to access that kind of transit is important. The other issue we have is around transit-oriented development, which is also wonderful, but as other people have discussed, if transit-oriented development, for example, the One Bay Area grant, if that doesn't have policies with it that ensure that low-income communities of color are not pushed out of their neighborhoods, it's not really doing what I think we want it to do, which is to strengthen communities and not move certain communities to the edges of our region rather than fully integrating them. And I guess third would be if there could be a little more clarity about how the operations and maintenance numbers may or may not include additional service or resumption of cut service. I think it would be very helpful for us to be able to know what the breakdown of those operations and maintenance is so we can see if there's going to be some resumption of service. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott Peterson. And then Keith Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members of the Commission. Scott Peterson with the East Bay Economic Development Alliance. We are also a member of the Bay Area Business Coalition. You heard from some of our colleagues earlier, so I'd like to associate ourselves with the request for information that we sent to you this week. I did arrive a little late. I apologize for that. So I was in reviewing the packet, and looking over the minutes, I assume I missed an announcement about why we're not hearing the preferred transportation scenario that was scheduled this morning. And that leads to, or I think that directly connects to our request for information that, and our concern that the timing here is not allowing for meaningful exchange of information and perspectives on the preferred alternatives. I think as elected representatives here, many of you representing cities, it may be important for you to go back and check with your city staff and your own bodies to find out if your own councils or have managed to submit comments or questions about the preferred alternative so far and what the timing is for that, because what we're hearing as a public-private partnership, many of our city members, because we convene an Economic Development Directors Council, they're feeling very constrained because they can't meet the timeline for assessing the proposals in order to inform their representatives in order to form a position that would then help you make a regional choice on land use and transportation. So I think what we're trying to do in asking the questions and raising these concerns is ask you to take that back to your own communities and assess that from your local perspective so that it can be used for the regional plan. Thanks
okay,
very
thank
much.
Thank you. Keith? It's Keith Cook.
Good morning, Commission Chair. My name is Keith Cook. I'm the principal engineer from the City of San Leandro. And I just wanted to just make a couple brief statements. And in general, we're in agreement with the proposed One Bay Area plan and the current distribution in funds, and kind of remarking or following after Tilly Chang's comments. However, I know there's always going to be challenges to the plan, and there'll be changes. And we just basically want to implore that that the funding for local streets and roads, and in particular, and the operation and maintenance of the proposed ITS systems, be maintained throughout the final changes in this plan. We see this right now. Maintaining our local streets is a major challenge, and just keeping some of our systems for improving the operations on our roadways running and communicating is always a major challenge. And if we can keep those fundings in place, I think we'll be better off. Thanks again.
Okay, thank you. And I'd like to bring it back to the committee. Scott, did you want to kick it off?
Well, yeah, I apologize, Mr. Chair. I think in the option A of the investment, are you asking us to give you some sort of feeling on option A and B in investment strategy one?
Sure.
Okay, so.
You can do it today or do it next month, but if you're ready.
I mean, I guess if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to ask a question. I mean, there's a $195 million difference between the two, and actually the more expensive one actually gets the lowest or the worst per capita CO2 emissions reduction, right?
Commissioner, I would say that in a $280 billion plan, you shouldn't worry about the dollar amounts.
Well,
here.
I think you should
worry more about the strategies and whether they make sense to you.
Well,
We could afford either package. We could afford both of them.
Okay, but I guess my point where I was going with this was, does this rely on other agencies like the Air District to come forward? Because, as you know, they're working on a regional public charging system also.
We would certainly try to pass that.
That's my question.
But we do have an amount of funds reserved in the plan that we're calling climate initiatives, and how we deploy those funds is really the issue before you. Do we deploy them in option A's way or option B or option C, D, or E? I'm sure some of the comments you had today suggest some other alternatives. What we do need to do is to close the gap between the 9% that we're achieving in 2035 and the 15%, which is our target. And you've got sort of a menu here of choices to fill that gap.
So in option B, if we were going to go with the 55 mile an hour speed limit, which I'm sure Mayor Green supports.
This car doesn't know 55 miles an hour.
I thought I should be becoming a Giants fan.
But that would require state law, right?
We don't believe it requires a change in state law. It requires an action by Caltrans. They need to make certain findings when they change the speed limit, either up or down.
Okay, and then I guess I'm still struggling with the difference in the CO2 emissions reductions. It seems I'm just trying to figure out why when we do all this, you know, for $685 million, we get less of a reduction.
Again, we group the two packages together, Commissioner. The first package, option A, has more to do with the vehicles and how you drive the vehicles. B has more to do with fuel efficiency. So it was just a convenience. I wouldn't let that get in the way. If you want to mix and match, if you want to ignore these completely and suggest other ideas we ought to investigate, feel free.
Okay, well, you know, I just, you know, I'll continue to look at these. Due to the fact I sit on another popular agency that is a regulatory agency, the Air District, I think I may be a little cautious about moving forward with the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit because I don't want to be totally unpopular.
Jake McKenzie. Jake.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jake McKenzie, representing 9 Sonoma cities and Sonoma County. A couple of observations. We last night in Sonoma County had a meeting of the mayors and council members meeting. We have our regular meetings of the Sonoma County Transportation Authority. At the Transportation Authority meeting, representatives from each of the cities that are present, we have continued on a monthly basis to discuss the direction we are going with these matters. So my exhortation last night, Mr. Chair, to my fellow mayors and council members was that their transportation authority representatives need to be going back to their councils and drawing their attention to what is going on. And I'm assuming that likewise our colleagues in ABAG are exhorting their colleagues. I have requested that as the MTC commissioner representing this bunch of people I just told you about, that I would be privy to any communications that they would have. It is not for want of trying to get the attention of my fellow elected officials in Sonoma County, number one. Number two, it is my intention after this meeting today to have electronically distributed through our mayors and council members listserv the documentation that we have been considering. I would agree with an earlier speaker from the public that it is important to get the reaction of individual jurisdictions, but I don't think any of the one of us here representing our various constituencies can hold ourselves responsible for forcing other people to read complex documents, and I will grant that these are complex. I'll get off that particular soapbox, Mr. Chair, and just say that it would seem to me, I'm coming at it maybe a wee bit differently than Commissioner Haggerty, but under options A and option B on climate policy initiatives, if it is in fact the determination that it's that 1% slice of the pie that should go towards these initiatives, then yes, we could mix and match, but unfortunately, if we mix the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit out of this conglomeration, then you're spending even less than that 1%. However, I did note that Transform and their comments have made suggestions as to other additional policy items that could be included, and I would certainly be supportive of taking another examination. The 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, I don't think politically works, Mr. Chair, somehow or other. That's not any great flash of brilliance on my part.
That's true.
Why are we different?
How do you mean? Are you different? Do you think it'll work?
No, that's what I'm saying. It won't work.
Well, then, if we take it out of the mix, then, according to this, we'd have $260 million that we wouldn't be spending. So we can be spending it then, I would suggest, on other climate policy initiatives, such as those suggested in Transform's letter. So that's my comment for the time being, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I've got Mark Green, Tom Bates, Dave Campos, and Kevin, you'll be, and Sam. Okay, so Mark Green, please.
Several things. One, under the strategy number five, when you're talking about efficiency and trying to string everything out of the existing system that we can, I don't think that can be stressed enough. I know we've done that in our own county. We had that transit sustainability meeting earlier this week, and I think that is something which resonates greatly across all political spectrum, actually, as well as actually has a tangible effect on any agency going out and being able to get a measure passed on their own once they've shown that they have the austerity measures in place in their own agency. So I think that this idea of getting efficiency is paramount. I actually strongly believe that. As getting back to the, I think it was on page 10, it shows in here, again, I just have to love pointing this out, that the sales tax on that little chart was the only thing that was higher was the so-called anticipated revenue, which I'm not really sure where the anticipation is coming from, but that was sort of unanswered. I just want to keep stressing out the importance of sales tax, which ties me back to the first point I made. And I also brought up Wednesday that had about the effect of a pebble hitting the Pacific Ocean, but I'll keep bringing it up. And at some point, the numbers need to be generated as to what it would take to get either the San Mateo or Dumbarton bridges, one of the two, up to a lifeline status. It's not, oh, it'll be functional in 6 or 8 months, but we need to see what one of those two bridges it would take to get that to a functional status, just like the Bay Bridge, which it rightfully needs to be, or the one of the two bridges, I think it is, in the north. So one of those two bridges from the East Bay to the peninsula needs to be investigated as to what it would take to make that. Because if you're talking about sustainability in an investment strategy for the next 30, 40 years, we need to be seeing what the economic downfall would be if we don't do that. Because my guess would be that the economic benefit would be much greater by keeping it open than whatever the cost would be. So that would be something which, again, I think we're missing that whole equation in here, that whole project. And specifically on that strategy of A or B, as some of my colleagues to my right have figured that one out already, that I don't want to go back to a catatonic state of driving at 55 miles an hour, which is really what it is. And no, yeah, you hiss, whatever you want to do, that's fine with me. I won't lose any sleep tonight. So, the last thing I will do sitting here or anywhere else in transportation will be voting to go back to a 55 mile an hour speed limit. I'd probably become a vegetarian for a week, a month before I would do that. And, we have other measures on here. I really think that the acceleration of electric vehicles has a bunch of, again, economic benefits, which we're not picking up here. The economy which it takes to build those vehicles, the recharging of it, we're not factoring that into here. Again, the upside of going farther in that or faster in that direction, as well as, again, if you're really talking about reducing dependency on foreign oil, let's start doing it rather than just going to 55 miles an hour. So those are my thoughts, Mr. Chair, at this time.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Tom Bates and then Dave Campbell.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm Tom Bates, representing Alameda County Cities. First of all, I just want to join the little chorus about obviously option A under the investment strategy is the one that makes the most sense, and we really should rule out the other. The other thing I think was raised around that issue, however, is the question about low-income people and how we might figure out some way that we might be able to subsidize some way for people to be able to take advantage of that option A. I also want to talk for a moment about the One Bay Area grant framework, which is really going to be discussed next at our next meeting, but I think it's important to bring it up. I brought it up before. I think that we really need to make sure that as we delegate and provide a substantial amount of money to CMAs, that they actually carry out the will that we want them to do. And so in particular, I'm very concerned about, I don't see how the communities that have performed, that have built the low-income housing, that have zoned for the low-income housing, and are prepared to build the low-income housing around transit, or any kind of housing around transit, they need to be prioritized, and they need to know that when the scheme of things, when a CMA, when we deal it out the money to them, they're not going to necessarily think that's the most important thing to fund. And I think it clearly is, and we want to, people who have done the work, people who are doing the work and plan to do the work in the future need to be recognized and approved. And I think we need to make a requirement for that when we pass that through. In addition to that, I mentioned this before, the low-income housing is particularly perplexing, and we know we have a great need in this region for providing low and moderate and workforce housing, and it's not going to happen unless we make it happen, and we need to put in place incentives or requirements that require that to occur. It could be on the carrot side. We could say that, when the CMAs make these decisions, that they weigh heavily communities that are willing to absorb and take in low and moderate income people. Because given the choice, developers, are not going to go there. Now, some cases they might want to have low-income housing. They might want to take advantage of the state density bonus to get a little higher. But that's a small portion. That's only 10% of the site. So, again, we need to if we just sit and say it's going to happen, it's not going to happen unless we make it happen in some way. And in that, I would think I would prefer incentive program. The CMAs, when they look at these projects, say we're going to reward people who are doing the work, and we're going to also give credit for people who are willing to absorb the low and moderate income people. And then I'd lastly think if it was possible, I'd like them also to consider, when they look at this, When we build, we put this investment together, we build these PDAs, we're trying to invest in the PDAs, I think it's important to have, again, maybe an incentivized program where they're going to provide some kind of transit passes for people. In other words, if you're going to have a unit there and you're going to build it, and we're doing it in Berkeley, and I think other communities are now picking up on it, it's not that much. I mean, you can go to the transit agency, like in AC's case, we're talking about $11 a month. But everybody in that new building, be it an office building or be it a residential building, gets a pass. Now, they, you know, obviously, some people are not going to utilize it, but others are. And so that's what and it provides incentives for us to help fund that system that we need in place to make the PDA successful. And then lastly, I think the issue about displacements, we ought to put that in place too. And in other words, you start saying, well, we're going to reward those that are doing well. We're going to require that they provide, you know, we incentivize low-income housing. We want them to provide transit passes to enable the transit agencies to continue to operate there, and then to have in place ordinances for displacement. I don't think that's too difficult. I mean, a displacement ordinance is not an awesome thing. I mean, all you have to do is say somebody, if you're going to displace a person, that you're going to have an opportunity to return once the new building is built, or have some other place they can move to. It's not that cumbersome. But I'm just afraid, you know, my experience from the state legislature with 58 counties and, once you say you want this to happen, unless you have some way to see that it's going to happen, it's just not going to happen, folks.
Thank you, Tom. Dave Campos, Dave.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I do want to echo the comments that were made by Tilly Chang of the San Francisco County Transportation Authority and thank the staff for the amazing work that has been done on this. I think it's really impressive to see where we are. And so I think that, you know, we really need to make sure that we acknowledge those efforts. I also want to associate myself with the comments that were made by Mayor Bates. I think that the issues that he raised are issues that are very important, and I hope that between now and the time that we have to finalize this, that we do get at least a response and an inclusion of some of those issues being addressed. I have a couple of questions that I wanted to see if I could ask of staff through the chair with respect to some of the comments that have been made, and I'm wondering if we can get some thoughts from staff on those comments. On strategy one, and one of the issues that was raised is that here we're talking about strategies that are essentially emission strategies that they're not taking into account the transportation and land use strategies that were supposed to be the focus under SB 375. And I'm wondering if staff has any response to that, any thoughts on that.
Commissioner, if I could address that one. It is true that Senate Bill 375 discusses at some length those kinds of strategies. It is also true that over its legislative history, the legislature considered a requirement to reduce VMT per capita, vehicle miles traveled per capita, instead of greenhouse gas per capita. They chose the latter, and they chose it intentionally so that MPOs like ours would have the flexibility to choose from a wide array of strategies. And I will tell you that we would not be alone. The other three agencies that have adopted their plans already have relied on some of these kinds of strategies in A and B to reach their target. And the simple fact is, especially here in the Bay Area, I don't know if we can go back to slide five, Doug, but we have an especially tough task because, number one, we're starting in a better position than the other three metropolitan areas. That's good for us. But it means that the progress we have to gain is that much more difficult because we're starting with a lower greenhouse gas emission per capita baseline. And secondly, we're growing slower than the rest of them. And as they say, it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. It's a lot easier when you're growing faster to affect some more significant change than when you're growing slower. Because in our case, we have to rely on trying to change the behavior of people who are ingrained in a certain kind of behavior already. So I do believe it's the case that it's certainly consistent with the law that we can rely on a mixture of strategies, both transportation, land use, and others. And I think it's also going to be necessary. I don't think there is a land use strategy in our region that's going to get us a 15% reduction. There may be one that's going to get us an insurrection along with it, but I don't think there's one that really is feasible.
Well, I guess thank you for that response. I think my question is less about what the law requires. I mean, clearly there's a lot of flexibility here, and I don't think that there is anyone who thinks that what you're proposing is not something that's permitted. But it's a question of what, you know, given that we do have flexibility, what choices we should make. And to the extent that other regions are choosing some of these choices, I don't know that it necessarily means that that's where we have to go. And so I'm trying to understand the extent to which we can incorporate some of these other strategies into this approach.
Commissioner, we certainly can, but I would like to highlight for you one other constraint, which Doug is on page 17. And this is a very significant one. And again, it's underlaid by good news. The overwhelming emphasis that the Commission historically has placed, and in this plan, if you adopt it, you will place more emphasis on it than any other metropolitan area in the nation, is in taking care of the infrastructure you've already built. That's really taking care of the legacy that we've been given by our parents and grandparents. When you're spending 90% of your money on that stuff, you really don't have much left to deal with things that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And I don't think it's a bad thing to do what we're doing here. You know, the BART system is running the oldest train cars in the United States. Good thing we have a new microphone system. So I think we have an obligation to do this, but it does mean that if we're growing slower, our land use strategy can only achieve so much. And if we're spending 90% of our investment income on maintenance, the remainder can only do so much. And that does, I think, place a priority on looking at some of these other strategies to round out the picture.
You're on the list.
Well, I appreciate that, Steve. And I think what I would simply ask along the lines of what has been, you know, raised by other commissioners is, you know, that we also think about, you know, what else can be added to this. And I do think that we have some time and an opportunity to do that. And I would simply ask, you know, for that flexibility.
And we'll be doing that. I think we're hearing some good comment from you, and you're clearly, and maybe, Mr. Chairman, before the day is done, I can go down swinging on the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, but I'll save that for another comment.
I have a couple of other questions, if I may, and God knows that I don't want to force anyone to become a vegetarian here, but... I do want to talk about the issue of equity and what's happening to the potential displacement, and Mayor Bates, you know, raised this issue. But as was noted by some of the advocates, you're talking about low-income families having to spend 84% of their income on housing and transportation, and I do think that, you know, there has to be a respect for local control and counties and jurisdictions making their own decisions, but I also think that we have to create incentives for them to make the right choices. So I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about sort of what else can be done to create those incentives.
Commissioner, I think we do have two bits of news for you on that will be coming to you next month. The first is we have a third revision of the One Bay Area grant proposal that's now out for comment. You haven't seen it yet, but a number of people have, and we'll be bringing that to you in May for you to consider, I think we hope, in final form. And it does include some language and some ideas on the displacement issue. You know, you're going to be the judge whether it's strong enough or comprehensive enough or, in some cases, too intrusive, but we do have a start on that, and so that will be coming to you next month. We also will be bringing to you a targets analysis that will include, I think, some updated information from the material that I think this 84% figure is being extracted from. And I will just ask you and others to recall that when we presented that information, I think it was your colleague, Commissioner Azambrato, who questioned whether it included the subsidies that some low-income folks receive to offset some of those expenses. And we answered that it did not. So I do believe that what we presented you several months ago now was an incomplete picture, and we'll be presenting you next month what I hope will be a more complete picture of that question. I don't mean to minimize the issue, because it's not like it's going to go from 80% to zero, but it will probably come down a bit, and I think we'll give you a better context for the discussion you'll have about the One Bay Area grant and whether we've got it right yet on the displacement question.
And I appreciate that. I think it's really important. And I think it's really important to make sure that we have strategies that are relevant to all, you know, people and to the very diverse populations that we have. You know, I'm taking the example of the electric vehicles. I'm very supportive of electric vehicles. But I also know that for low-income people and for, you know, a lot of working families, that's not something that they can necessarily avail themselves of, you know. But I do have a final question about the service cuts and the point that was raised about how do we incorporate the possible restoration of those cuts in this effort.
I have to say, I think that's a more difficult question than it on the surface appears. And I'll give you two examples, perhaps. I do believe that during this recession, some transit agencies were forced to cut some service that they probably would prefer they didn't have to. And so that clearly becomes a priority when new funds become available. In the case of VTA, on the other hand, they went through a fairly comprehensive analysis of their whole service platform and concluded that quite a bit of it was, in our nomenclature, low performing. It really wasn't achieving the objective that they wanted to achieve, and they redirected the funds to other service. So they didn't undertake the exercise to save money. They redirected and redeployed their resources. So I would venture to say that in the case of VTA, there are quite a few routes that were cut that they would probably say should not be restored. So I think it's a fairly detailed and granular question that if you want us to explore it, it's going to take some time because we look at things at a regional scale, and transit routes are very local. And if that's the direction you'd like us to take, we can certainly explore it. But it's going to take us some time working with all of these systems to tease out, you know, which routes were you reducing or realigning for policy reasons, and which were you just forced to do because you didn't have the money?
I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I know that, I think that it would be helpful to at least have some of that information. I do know, for instance, that as you noted, a number of the cuts that were made in San Francisco, and I'm sure in other jurisdictions, there are reasons that makes sense, you know, that some of those cuts probably happen. But at the same time, I also know that many of the cuts disproportionately impacted certain communities, not just low-income communities, but a lot of working-class communities, middle-class communities. So I think that as we're thinking about sort of providing a plan that is equitable in terms of, you know, what the region is doing for all these diverse groups, that I think it might be helpful to have that information. But that's my take. Again, thank you to the staff for the great work.
Thank you, Dave. I have Kevin, Sam, Ann, Julie, and Mark Lewis. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Kevin, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve preempted my question a bit. It is on slide 17. I'm struck by this disparity between the Bay Area, among the Bay Area and the other regions of the state. So how much of that is attributable to the aging nature of our infrastructure as related to these other areas? And, you know, I support Fix It First, but with just that 10 to 12% to utilize in new investments, it does make our job very difficult in moving the needle on greenhouse gas. Just can you talk about how, expand on that a little bit and what some of our challenges are in relation to other?
Commissioner, I think there are several things behind this. And look, I won't start with the most important, but I'm sure there is some apples and oranges going on here. When we sort of synchronized our watches with these other MPOs, we tried to make sure we were all accounting for data in the same way, but I'm sure there's been some diversion. So keep that in your mind. Secondly, keep in your mind that we are growing slower than the other regions. So to some extent, we can afford to spend a little bit more on maintenance because the imperative to deal with growth isn't as strong here. Third, the Bay Area is one of the older places in California in terms of settlement. Muni is 100 years old this year. The BART system is quite old, as I said earlier. A lot of our highway infrastructure, a lot of it was built in California here first, and some of the stuff down south was built more recently. So I think it's a combination of factors, but maybe I'm leaving the most important explanation for last. I think it's been a conscious policy decision that we as a staff, that you as policymakers have supported, that we've got to take care of what we've built. And the ironic thing is that when Doug runs the model, it doesn't give us any credit for that in greenhouse gas reductions. But I'll tell you what, if we stopped doing that, if we stopped that heavy emphasis on maintenance, the analogy I would give you is Manhattan in the 1970s, where people were leaving New York City in droves because they stopped investing in everything, in cops, in subways, in all of it. And we clearly are a long way away from that, but we're a long way away from it, not just because of our good looks and charm. We're a long way away because we've done something about it, and it's come at a cost, as you say, which is that we don't have as much revenue and investment to deal with growth.
Very good, thank you. And I, for one, am intrigued by the 6% greenhouse gas reduction for 55 miles an hour. I may be alone on that, but it's hard to ignore.
Thank you. Sam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to echo, I very much appreciate Supervisor Campos's comments about the need to restore transit service, and I'm sure that's true in a lot of areas. What I think Steve was referring to is VTA just found a lot of empty buses going to affluent neighborhoods that simply shouldn't be running. And I think, you know, I'm sure that many of our agencies have performed that analysis. I hope that all of them do, because what's resulted for us is a significant increase in ridership and certainly better service for those who are transit dependent. I think that I'm going to weigh in on the 55 mile an hour speed limit issue, just because I want to see if there's any way we can encourage Commissioner Green to think about alternative food choices. I'm not sure we have to eat the elephant in one bite on the 55 mile an hour speed limit issue. It seems to me that there may be corridors that are so congested anyway that you might think about experimenting, trying a pilot project, and see what happens. I recognize that this is about as unpopular a thing as we could possibly do for transportation if we were to do it Bay Area wide, but it's not obvious to me that we necessarily have to pick Commissioner Green's freeway to do it, or all of them, yes. In any event, I think that we shouldn't completely dismiss it. I think we all recognize how politically unpopular it is, but there may be specific instances where it starts to make sense to roll out, and as we become more congested as a region, and we're going to get more congested, it may not look so bad 15 years from now as it does today. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox on that issue. I had a question about the assumptions we're making on savings of greenhouse gas emissions on slide. Well, regarding option A, the electrical vehicle acceleration, what assumptions are we making about the source of the electricity for those electrical vehicles that lead us to believe that we're going to get some greenhouse gas emission savings?
Yeah, the research we show here on the West Coast, our electric production is actually fairly green compared to what we see back east. I don't think we, you know, if we were sitting in New Jersey or something, I think we'd be making a much different estimate on the greenhouse gas emissions we could save by electric vehicles. And what we've shown here in the western United States is that because most of the electric production is through natural gas, it tends to be much more cleaner, and that there is, in fact, a net reduction in greenhouse gas emissions through electric vehicles.
And so is the assumption that our current allocation of fuels that produces electricity, is that would remain the same, or that there is some trend for improving our shift to renewables to meet state standards? What's sort of the assumption?
No, there's definitely room for trends in having our electric production get much cleaner. I mean, part of it is embodied in AB 32 as well. So we're taking credit for that.
Okay. So we're taking credit for a hopeful future and a shift to renewables.
Yes.
Okay. And then turning to the appendices in the original report, looks like we're counting on for the $56 billion or so of the proposed trade-off investment pool, we've got $14 billion in anticipated revenue, and I wait with great anticipation to understand what the anticipated revenue will be, but I know we don't know exactly, and I guess that's why it's anticipated. But then the $12 billion for sales tax reauthorization, and I'm wondering what the assumption is there. Is it that every existing sales tax will get reauthorized, and or some percentage of them will?
Yes, the assumption is that all the sales taxes will get reauthorized. The one exception is that with Alameda, it actually assumes not only a reauthorization but an increase based on what's currently under discussion for the ballot in November.
Okay. Thanks, Alex. And then finally, on Appendix 3, I see that, again, in that mysterious category called anticipated, we talked about Caltrain frequency and electrification in our last meeting, I know, and $59 million is anticipated in revenue to provide for that project, and I'm wondering what that $59 million refers to, because I thought we had a plan that pretty much allocated clearly local and regional share to make that project happen.
That is true that we do have a funding plan for the capital project. I might need to go back and review this, but it may also be that there were some service and frequency enhancements, and that may be where the anticipated is coming in, but I will need to review and make sure I'm accurate on that.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Ann?
Quickly, Ann Halstead representing Bay Conservation Development Commission. Number one, I think fix it first at 88% is a really big and important standard to live up to and to maintain our facilities and keep people living in the denser areas. So I hope that we can stick with that. Number two, I'd like to add my voice to supporting any reinforcement we can give to low-income housing that will also keep people near transit, as well as market rate median housing. I mean, we have the cost of housing in the Bay Area is one of the things that drives people outside the centers. So whatever we can do that moves in that direction, although I know this is not the intent of this policy. And number three, I think that all of the initiatives listed sound worth considering to me. I also am not willing to drop the 55-mile speed limit. I think that that's something we probably should consider in the long run. I am not an elected official, so I do understand the difference of my position, although I do have a husband who likes to drive fast.
Not you, of course.
Right. And so I'd like to keep that on the table. I'm looking at this list, I have to assume that we're thinking that they're all sort of equally feasible if we get the politics straight. Is that reasonable to say?
Commissioner, you have a list in both A and B,
right,
that we think represents some of the more cost-effective strategies. There are a lot of other ideas, and we can't claim to have looked at all of them, but we looked at some of them, and some of the ones that are often mentioned cost you a whole lot of money to get a very small gain.
Right.
you know, I think we heard from some public testimony that, look, this is still about driving. But the fact is most people are going to keep driving. And if you want to clean up the driving, often you have to deal with the drivers. You know, transit can be an effective strategy, but the fact is most travelers are not going to use transit. So this is really getting at the source of the greenhouse gas issue.
I was really asking about whether we think they are equally feasible within the time frame what we're talking about.
I think generally speaking, yes. Look, the discussion you've had on the speed limit, even though it's within Caltrans's authority, Caltrans is a public agency that works for the governor. And so the governor's views on the subject, as well as the legislature's, are certainly going to matter a lot if we were ever to pursue that strategy.
Thank you.
Okay, Julie?
Yeah, I want to thank staff for all the work that's gone into these reports, because the last 2 months we've had reports that have been really incredibly detailed, and I know there's been an awful lot of time invested in that, and that's not to say that we're done by any stretch, but I at least want to say thank you for all the work that's gone into these, because it's been a marathon for you guys, and you've been sprinting the whole way, and that's tough. Based on the two options that we see on the board today, and I realize there are going to be refinements, and I also realize that this is not the only time we're going to look at these strategies. There may well be strategies that are better for the first few years, the first target deadline, versus the long term. And while strategy B, I think, does not go over at all today, 2025, it might. I'm probably not going to be here to make that decision, but you know, by that time, maybe something else makes more sense. To me, the importance of what we're looking at is prioritizing what's best for the early term right now, because 4 years from now, we're going to do this again and look at what works and what doesn't work. So I think that's the way to start. I think the fix at first is absolutely critical. All of the CMAs, I think, have been unanimous in saying we've got to maintain what we have. We cannot let it go because it costs way too much to replace it if it falls apart. I think that some of the strategies that have been mentioned in all of the comments become part of the implementation plan, so they don't all have to be decided in minute detail before we go ahead and adopt the plan in May, and obviously revise it somewhat as we go forward. But I do think they are important to keep in mind for how we roll this out to the, especially with the One Bay Area grant, to the CMAs and how that money goes forward. I think one of the things that I feel somewhat after the last few weeks compelled to caution us about is not to, while I agree with the comments that Mayor Bates and others have made, I would be careful about how many restrictions and strings we put on this. The whole idea was to make the One Bay Area grant money a little more flexible so that the CMAs have a little discretion and they can make choices that are appropriate for their own jurisdictions. And I think we at ABAG at least have heard loud and clear over the last month that choices and local control are huge. And I think if we step too far across that line, we wind up getting so much backlash that we become dismissed. And I think it's going to be a fine line to walk. But I think guidance, suggestions, maybe incentives without directives, is probably a better way to go at this point. So I think each county, based on their unique circumstances, are going to have slightly different approaches to what they are going to want to prioritize and what will actually be more effective for them. So I think those are interesting things to look at. The electric car thing, it's interesting, our county's TDM projects are focusing heavily on a faster, more widespread deployment of electric electric charging stations available to the public in public areas, and how do we get those in place? It occurs to me that some of the things we might want to think about as suggestions would be all new development automatically including solar that would take care of the charging stations. They're not horribly expensive to install, and the net gain might be pretty big. So, and car share programs and things like that. So I think there are a lot of things we can do for implementation of that going forward. But overall, I just want to say I think this is a good strategy. I'm not ready to go to 55 miles an hour. And anecdotally, I've tried 55 versus 65 versus 75 in my own car. And I got to tell you, it gets better mileage at 70 than it does at 55, all things equal. So, you know, not every car is built that way, but some of us are out on the open. Well, that's at the open road. In town, yeah, there are differences, but you know, for whatever it's worth, thanks to staff.
What do you drive,
Mark Luce? Mark.
Thank you. I want to support the overall approach of supporting reliability by maintaining what we have. I think if we don't have reliability, we won't have ridership, and even though it doesn't show up in the calculations, we'll see more traffic and more greenhouse gases and the like. I do want to make the observation, however, that I think we're sort of settling for second best by looking at transit as being the ultimate goal here, having people live near transit and use transit. I think the ultimate goal should have people living near where they work. Social equity means not just vehicle miles reduced, but commute hours reduced. People spending 2 hours a day trying to get to a low-income job is just not fair, and whether they're riding on BART or not. And so, I know there's only so much we can do, but I think we need to look at tax incentives, subsidies, partnerships to help people who are working to live near where they work. I think there's a lot of opportunities to do that. We haven't really explored it. I think we're sort of addicted to the transit mode of thinking. But we really ultimately need to have people live in the same community in which they work. It's only fair to them so that they can attend to their family affairs during the day, spend less time commuting and more time living. I think as we look at what the policy options are, we just need to investigate how we can do that better.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Before I go to Mark, Dave, let me take Dave. And then yeah, okay.
Thank you. I want to follow that with a similar theme. We're back in D.C. with our little delegation of the commission, there was a very lively discussion with Senator Feinstein's staff that kind of culminated in a discussion about tax incentives, or what is it that's holding up the actual development of TOD on the housing side. And since we're all here together, ABAG, MTC, and, you know, this strategy 4 is largely dependent on the private sector at some point coming through with those numbers. And as we know, even if they come through with the numbers that ABAG is currently projecting between now and 2040, it's going to constrain jobs by 100,000. We're being as aggressive as we can. We can't accommodate what would otherwise be the unbridled or natural job growth. So we're in a constraint mode already. And I thought it was a great question. I shouldn't probably say this publicly. I forget the Matt's last name, who we met with in Feinstein's office, Steve, but it came down to, you know, what's happening, because we got 34-34. We have general plans that are aggressive. There was, you know, RDA in the past, granted not in the future, but even with the best RDA investments, you weren't seeing these corridors fill up. And the question was, what can be done really at the federal level to create the kind of incentives that are going to make, you know, multifamily and a kind of high-density housing go again? And I was talking since that trip to some of those who were on the trip, but also to Ken Kirky. And if you go by, tell me if I'm misquoting you, but if we go back and look at where production fell off, it was exactly what we told to the senator's office. It really goes back probably before that young man's time, to the Reagan Tax Reform Act, where tax-exempt bond financing was eliminated all of a sudden overnight for private sector multifamily investment, and everything came to a grinding halt. It's great for remaining multifamily property owners like some in my family who hold on to these assets and won't let them go anymore. You know, they're never at any significant vacancy level because, you know, that's what's happening out there. There's no private sector competition or opportunity to make those things go. So my point is this. I don't know where it belongs. It's not within our jurisdiction per se to do that, so I'm not sure, you know, that it belongs right here in the plan spelled out. But I'll say, you know, we got a lengthy letter here from the Bay Area business community, the business coalition, as it's called, I guess, you know, talking about what we should do and what we can do and asking a lot of questions. And maybe that partnership, you know, needs to become more active in this regard. And 'cause if these numbers fall short, which the last couple decades of history would say they will, if they fall short, we lose on job growth, but we also lose on these GHG reduction numbers because we're banking on it. We're literally banking this whole plan on that housing growth happening. And I think it's important enough for us to figure out how do we make that a major you know, cornerstone or keystone of our legislative advocacy going forward. I think, you know, when an office as prominent as Senator Feinstein's office is inviting from us here in the Bay Area, I don't think that question was directed at all the MPOs in the country. He said, you guys tell us what needs to be done because you've got a lot of these corridors that just aren't filling up with housing. We need to know what incentives are necessary to make that happen, be it through HUD or, you know, I understand tax incentives aren't going to get passed by Congress anytime overnight, but it shouldn't stop us between now and 2040 for advocating for whatever it is that we need and spelling it out clearly here so that successors of this commission understand that that's just an important linchpin to this plan. Thank you. My 2 cents.
Thank you, Dave. Scott, Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 25, it talks about the new starts and the small starts, and I guess the recommended spending for $1.8 billion. And I really hate the direction in which I'm about to go because as I have sat on this commission, I have never, ever been parochial, and nor have I not thought about my colleagues in other communities as they try to get transportation improvements and even transit in their own communities. So I'm a little conflicted with my own set of policies, but I do believe since this is a long-range plan and it is something that we need to look at, when I look at this and the expenditure of the $1.8 billion and then the $660 million sitting in reserve, I can't help but look and see that communities like Contra Costa, San Mateo, North Counties, and even to some extent Alameda County are pretty much being shut out. And I'm a little concerned that as we move forward with these expenditures and leave these other $660 million in reserves, that I really believe that this $660 million in reserves should be set aside for the communities that are the counties that I just mentioned. You know, I've been a great supporter of the BART San Jose project. In fact, I was allowed to speak yesterday, and it was a great honor at the groundbreaking. I think it's a very needed project. So I'm not saying that these projects that are before us are not needed. They certainly are, and I'm certainly supportive of them. But I'm just a little concerned about the $660 million that's left behind.
And Mark Green.
That's more of a statement. It is a question. I'd like some sort of response from staff as to maybe some thoughts on that.
Commissioner, I think that is clearly a policy matter for the commission to decide. As you indicate, you know, the nature of the New START investment is that it tends to be large and lumpy. You know, it's not spread evenly around the Bay Area. And it's also fair to say that the history of our New START investment has centered on the peninsula. This would be the third generation of New START projects for the Bay Area, and the prior two have focused on the peninsula, and I think there are some good reasons for that in terms of investing in complementary land use strategies and the like. What we have tended to do in the East Bay is use local and state and non-federal funds to make those investments. So if the commission wants to express a preference or a limitation in terms of that reserve, that's your prerogative to do so.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, based on the answer that we just heard, that I would hope that staff could maybe bring SAP some sort of language back that would maybe help us get through this, what I consider an equity, and maybe make sure that Contra Costa, the North Counties, and San Mateo, and like I said, even Alameda County, get at least some sort of deference in relationship to the $660 million to make sure that we are able to participate for that.
Okay. Mark?
First of all, I just wanted to let David, Ann, and Scott know that I actually am in favor of a 50-mile-an-hour speed limit on Market Street. that would work. And secondly, on the investment strategy 3, where it says focus growth around transit, I think, which is certainly I've been in favor of and still am, but I do think that one thing that needs to be a corollary of that is that we need also to focus transit around growth, or where the growth has been and we haven't put the transit there. And I am thinking of two spots in the East Bay, meaning at Bishop Ranch and the whole eastern part of Alameda County, where there's going to be much more growth in terms of jobs, I think, coming up. And even though they're not urbanized areas in the classic definition of it, again, if we're looking, talking back to what David mentioned a couple minutes ago, if we're trying to keep the economy going, we need to also be realizing where the developers, where the investment community is going to be putting money to grow, and we need to be aware of that. You know, we can try to channel everything into one parameter, but if indeed the people spending the money are going to be spending it somewhere else, we need to accept that reality at some point. Secondly, in our county, to tout our horn a little bit, again, under the assumption that, A, that it wins in November, which I think it will, with our additional half-cent, our modeling shows that in our county, again, under the assumption that it wins and is implemented, that in 2035 we would have a 24% reduction in greenhouse gases per capita in our own county, and I might add, without the ballyhooed 55-mile-an-hour speed limit being part of that plan. If we put that in there, it would not win. So the point there, meaning that I think it would be worthwhile for our, I'm talking about our staff here in a more parochial sense, the Alameda County Transportation Commission staff, and talking with the MTC staff to see if there's anything where there's any way that any of that could bleed over, that we might be able to lift our own, and talk about region-wide status there in terms of the greenhouse gas reduction percentages. And lastly, getting back to this first item, which was talked right off by the top of the first few speakers, the Contra Costa and East Bay EDA people especially, from our staff, what are we content with our answers to this point, that we've answered all their questions, or do we see any further dialogue? And in terms of the time that they're requesting, which may not be realistic, given I know the constraints we have to keep momentum going forward, how are we going to be meeting their concerns with our timeline constraints?
Commissioner, I do think we can provide answers to the questions they seek in roughly the timetable they want. Quite a few of them are fairly detailed and technical, but I think we're in the process of assembling that information, so we'll get it to them as quickly as we can.
Okay. Sam and Jake, I'd like to see if we can wrap up.
Yeah, absolutely. Commissioner Hagerty raises an important point. I want to be clear. I certainly don't oppose a set-aside of some sort for North Bay and East Bay with what we believe is the remainder of the New Starts and Small Starts money. Recognizing, though, at least I think it should be explicit that, you know, the $2.5 billion that we're assuming there, I think we all recognize is, at this point, an artificial ceiling. And we don't know exactly what the feds are going to do over the next 30 years. And it seems to me that we ought to have the flexibility on those existing programs where
we're proposing New Starts money for, that'd be the BART and Chance Bay and the Small Starts projects as well, where if it looks like they're able to get more federal money and they can do it and they need the federal money, we shouldn't oppose their ability to get more federal money. But I certainly don't have any problem with sort of an earmark, for lack of better words, of some. I know that's a bad word to use.
Yeah, that's what I use
but you know, a set aside of the remainder for other regions that are obviously not getting their share, recognizing this is, I think, as Steve said, lumpy. And it's impossible to spread evenly, but recognizing that other parts of the Bay should be getting this money.
Mm-hmm. And Jake, final?
Mr. Chair, very quickly, it would be very impolitic of me coming from the North to do anything other than endorse Mr. Haggerty's suggestion. I therefore endorse it.
The most of the things on my list have been addressed. I feel like the kid that has to go to the bathroom kept raising his hand, and so I finally have my chance to go. I do think the timeline with many of the questions that have been raised and the public's, the comments we're hearing there, this is a very aggressive timeline. Steve, I want to make sure that we do respond in a timely fashion. That I think it's very important that we address many of the issues that have been raised, you know, as we go forward, because we really need public support and we need many of our advocates behind this plan. And so we need to take the time to make sure that we do respond. The inventory on the PDAs, I think that's something a lot of us have been asking for, and I hope that's somewhere in the process and it's going to come out. For me, on the option A, I certainly support option A. I would like to see something or incentives for a low-income strategy. It's unfortunate. A lot of our low-income strategies, it's kind of like what Tom was talking about, these transit passes for new development, that really helps the operators, but I don't know that it necessarily helps low-income families. And, you know, so the low-income side of it needs to be a targeted strategy that we're getting those resources to the right people. You know, it's like senior discounts. Most seniors don't need it. And so we really, I think it's important that we focus on, you know, helping the right people and making so those limited resources get to them. On the reduced routes, I really feel it's important that those operators come back with some strategy or to actually clarify why some of those routes were cut. I really would caution us, you know, delving into much of the operation side of it. I think there's very important reasons why a lot of these routes have been cut, and some of them, I think it's been a very good strategy to do that, and the economy has helped make those tough decisions. The $660 million, Scott, thank you, you know, because that was a concern that I had, is that I think there needs to be some policy. You know, many of the commissioners are being asked to support a lot of these larger projects, which I think are very appropriate, but I do think there's an equity issue here, and so I would like to see some more discussion on the policy side of that. And on the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, I think it's something we ought to include because it'll take the focus off of all the other stuff we're trying to do, and it'll probably just fly right through. And so, and we probably could be a little bit more aggressive on some of the other things that we want to do. And so with that, and I agreed with many of the policies, but on the low income, I really think that we have to start focusing that strategy and really target that investment and how we can help. And I agree with Tom. If we don't have something in place, it's not going to happen. It just historically, you can just look at how it's worked with many of the redevelopment agencies. That's why they got in trouble. They didn't spend that 20% set aside, and it really didn't produce the housing that they were that it was intended for. And so with that, there's plenty of opportunities. Steve, could you just comment on how you think you're going to be responding to all of this and that process? Because I think it's important that, you know, many of the interests, that's an important issue.
Let me say, first of all, Mr. Chairman, on the question of timing, all the way through this process, we have gotten comment that you need to slow down. I'm continually, I guess, surprised that This seems to be one of the few public agencies that's criticized for going too fast.
Yeah.
That's usually what we hear from the business community. You're too slow. Speed up. We're about out of time, and we have been squeezing the schedule because we've been responsive to those requests. We have been taking more time, a month here, a month there. It all adds up. We've now compressed the EIR period so sharply that I think we're at risk of not being able to get the work done in the time we have left. And if we are to make our deadline, which is April 2013, we don't have really any time left to give. Now, I do believe we can provide, in particular, the information that the business community has requested. But, look, I wouldn't think it's out of the realm of possibility that someone's going to stride up to the microphone next month and say, you haven't given us enough time. And I would just, I guess, precaution you, we're out of time at the staff level in terms of the work we need to do to get you to April of next year.
Well, I mean, you've even heard it from the commission and committee members. So, I mean, I just want to make sure that we respond to what we're hearing.
We are going to do so, but we've got a hard deadline to get this plan adopted, and there are consequences if we don't meet that deadline.
Right.
So it's not as if we can just take another couple of months because someone's got 10 more questions. There is a lot of information that's available, and we will provide as much additional information as we can. But I certainly believe that by May, you will have enough information to act. Now, the other thing, secondly, I'd ask you all and as well as our stakeholders to keep in mind is what we're asking you to do in May is to adopt a draft. We're not asking you to adopt the final document. And I know to a lot of people, they think that once you identify a preferred alternative, the deal's done, there's no change we can possibly make. I would caution us about that because this is our first time through this process, and I expect that we will learn more in the environmental review of this and other alternatives than we're typically used to doing. So I don't think it's inconceivable that we will exit the environmental process at the end of the year with perhaps some new ideas about what project you ought to adopt. And it may not be the project that you adopt next month. The bite at the apple next month is still not the last bite. It's the second to last. And it may very well be that we need to have another bite at it before we're done in the spring. I think the comments we've received today, I think, are manageable, and we can turn around some ideas for you at your next meeting. We won't give you options. We'll give you a recommendation, and you can act on it by motion. But I think what we've heard today is internally consistent. There's been a little disagreement. I would like to thank the few commissioners who stood up for a lower speed limit. $1 million a day. I'll just say one more thing. It would save Bay Area motorists $1 million a day if they were traveling at 55 as opposed to what they travel at. That's not small potatoes. 80 fatalities a year probably as well. But look, I think Director Pierce said it well. That's based upon $5 a gallon gasoline. If gas is $7 a gallon, people may think differently about this speed limit, and it's not like it's going down in the future. So I think that's what we take away, and we appreciate all the discussion we've had from you today as well as the public. I think it's all been constructive. And we can try to put together a draft recommendation for you next month.
Okay. Steve, I just want to emphasize that I'd like staff to work hard at just responding. Even if we don't agree, say we don't agree, we've addressed it, just make sure that we respond to as much of the comments that we've heard. I think
we certainly will.
That really is the most important issue. I don't want anybody to go away thinking that, no, we didn't hear you, or we ignored you, and so that's important that we respond. So with that said, this was an information item only. I want to thank staff, just a great presentation, good public comments, and so let's move on to item B. This is the compelling cases for low-performing projects. Dave, just be as concise as you can be. committee and commissioners are going to be on good behavior, so let's...
Yes, sir.
Good morning. Dave Vaughton from MTC's planning section. I'm here this morning to discuss the compelling cases we received from project sponsors of low-performing projects. And today we're going to ask you to approve a set of 9 low-performing projects for inclusion in Plan Bay Area based off of the cases submitted. Just a quick refresher on our progress to this point. MTC has conducted a performance assessment for all uncommitted projects proposed for inclusion in Plan Bay Area. The process created a level playing field, which all projects across the region were compared, and allowed us to identify outliers, both high performers and low performers, based on the Commission's guidance in February. You just heard about how we're moving forward on the investment strategy, including that strategy for high-performing projects, but we also need to consider those low-performing projects and make sure that they have a compelling case to justify their plan. Back in February, again, the Commission approved a set of criteria for making that type of compelling case. For making that type of compelling case. And remember that all projects, including these low performers, need to have a full funding plan to be included. 180 major uncommitted projects were analyzed. 13 were high performers, and they've been prioritized for that regional funding. And the bulk of the projects were middle performers and thus subject to CMA discretion based on funding constraints. The remaining 32 projects were identified as low performers. About half of those were transit projects. In general, they had low benefit cost ratios indicating a poor cost effectiveness. The other half were road projects, which did not strongly support the Plan Bay Area targets and therefore received low ratings on the targets assessment. This slide simply shows the criteria that you adopted back in February for low performing projects to make that case. A project needs to support at least one of the criteria listed on the screen and have a full funding plan to be included. Category 1 was for projects that did not have their benefits fully captured in the travel model. And since the travel model was only the basis for the benefit cost assessment, not the targets assessment, only projects with low benefit cost ratios could make a case under this category. The second category dealt with federal requirements and could be used for any of these low-performing projects. The cases here had to be made either under cost effectiveness for air quality improvements or for support of communities of concern through improved mobility or reduced air pollutants in those areas. In response to the performance assessment results, CMAs and project sponsors did reconsider including some of their projects in Plan Bay Area. As continued environmental study work was exempt from the compelling case process, 8 of those 32 low-performing projects were rescoped to focus solely on that phase. So these projects will not be proceeding towards construction in this RTP, but they'll have a chance to gain a greater understanding of their impacts, including environmental impacts, and they'll have a better foundation for requesting to be included in a future RTP. So some key projects that will be focusing on environmental work during this RTP cycle include Dumbarton Rail Phase 2, the SMART Phase 3 project from Windsor to Cloverdale, the SR 239 Brentwood to Tracy Expressway, and the US 101 widening project south of Gilroy. Another approach project sponsors took in response to the designation of low performers was to fully fund projects locally. And this therefore changed their designation to committed for Plan Bay Area. And 3 projects pursued this approach. This indicated their willingness to fund these projects using local sources, and as such, they'll be included in the plan. Projects that took this approach included an arterial widening project in Martinez and 2 VTA projects, the SR 152 toll-funded project and the Vasona Light Rail Extension, which VTA has agreed to fully fund with local sales tax dollars. Finally, 12 of the 32 projects are not being pursued by sponsors in Plan Bay Area. These projects may very well return for consideration in a future RTP, but based off of the performance work and the funding constraints, the CMAs and project sponsors decided not to pursue these projects this time around. So thanks to the responsiveness of our partners, this left only 9 of the 32 low-performing projects interested in pursuing the compelling case process. And as you can see here, the MTC staff recommendation is to approve all 9 of these cases made, and I'll go through them quite quickly. The Lifeline program, which funds programs and services that serve gaps specific to low-income communities across the area, received support based on their serving communities of concern across the region. There's the Capital Expressway Light Rail Extension Project in East San Jose that extends service from Alum Rock to the East Ridge Transit Center, one of VTA's most significant bus transfer facilities. And we recommend this, again, based off of the community concern. About 2/3 of the potential ridership would come from the low-income neighborhoods of East San Jose. The 84-680 interchange and 84 widening project would build aux lanes on I-680 near the 84 interchange and widen 84 from the 680 interchange east to Livermore. And this is recommended based off of the air quality cost effectiveness of the project from the project performance assessment. The Union City Station project also serves communities of concern as it constructs an infill station in Union City and it improves access to the station, including the existing BART station. The SMART project, Phase 2, would construct 1 station extensions in each direction from the initial operating segment, south to Larkspur and north to Windsor, as well as the pedestrian and bicycle pathway along the entire right-of-way. And this phased approach to the SMART project would lead to Phase 2 achieving a benefit-cost ratio greater than 1, reclassifying this phase of the project as a medium performer for Plan Bay Area, and staff recommends approving the project on this basis. There are 2 bus service frequency improvements in Marin Sonoma that, again, both serve communities of concern due to the low-income ridership on that system. There's the historic streetcar expansion program, which is in San Francisco and connects Fort Mason to the Caltrain Depot. This project has significant recreational and tourist ridership, as well as crowding issues on the existing streetcar line. And finally, the Farmers Lane Extension Project in Santa Rosa, which constructs a new arterial roadway in the southeast portion of the city and reduces traffic, which is currently diverting through a low-income community known as South Park. So again, for these 9 cases, our recommendation is that they be included in the final investment strategy. However, should you decide to reconsider the inclusion of one of these projects, the sponsor would have a number of alternatives, as I have discussed, including identifying another higher-performing funding priority, focusing on environmental studies in this RTP, or electing to fully fund the project using local sales tax dollars. In conclusion, we believe that the project performance process for Plan Bay Area has led to a more cost-effective plan that better supports the adopted targets, and that this final step of the multi-year performance process will lead us to a strong final investment strategy, which is slated for adoption in May. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions about the compelling case process or the specific projects that made cases. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Mike Tassano. Mike, the only speaker card I have on this item.
Well, since I'm the Mike Tassano, City of Pleasanton traffic engineer, since I'm the only speaker, I'll just say that I support staff's recommendation. Thank you.
That's a smart thing to do. As I say, don't talk us out of it. too many winners and losers on this one. Is there any further discussion, Mark?
I'd just like to, Mr. Chair, thank the Alameda County Transportation staff, as well as our own staff in Union City and the MTC staff for a triangulation of discussions, getting the Union City commuter rail station where it belongs. And I must say that as a lifelong Rams fan, I'm fascinated to see that the 49ers send a letter of support in also. So I'll acknowledge that. I'll acknowledge that publicly here, the support of the 49ers.
Mark,
here. I'll move the recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I was going to say that don't talk us out of it. It goes for you, too. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes. We have a motion. Is there a second?
I understand we do. And just very quickly under discussion, as the representative of the 9 Sonoma County cities and, particular interest to the Santa Rosa project and as a board member on SMART, I'd just like to thank the various staffs and SMART in the City of Santa Rosa and our own staff at Sonoma County Transportation Authority working with MTC staff for all of the efforts that have gone into getting us to this point.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Is there any dissent to the motion? Okay, seeing none, thank you. Public comments, Dave Campbell and Parisha Tata Weeks. All right, we wore Dave out. Parisha, you're up.
Carissa Fatehi Weeks from Public Advocates and the Broad-Based Six Wins Network of over 30 organizations you heard about earlier. I'd just like to quickly pick up on some of... First, I'd like to really thank you for lowering this podium. It's really something. Okay, so I wanted to pick up on some of the points made on the One Bay Area grant. Thank you, commissioners, to those of you that spoke to the importance of using these funds for promoting housing that's affordable to the low-income workforce and for the existing communities that are living the kinds of lifestyles that SB 375 is incentivizing. That is, they have low vehicle miles traveled, high transit ridership. Mr. Heminger referred to the newly revised version that's not before you today, but I did have the opportunity to review that because it was presented to the advisory groups earlier this week. And for a program whose purpose it is to support a regional vision of sustainability and equity, the newest proposal really delegates too much authority to the county CMAs and not enough to reward directly the local jurisdictions that are making the critical decisions about housing and land use. They're the ones taking these actions. So as a reminder, these are incentive funds. It's a voluntary program, and it's entirely reasonable for MTC to put a clearly communicated set of requirements on these funds to spell out what local governments need to do on production and on policies so that they can be eligible for the funds. And on that note, in closing, on Wednesday, your Regional Equity Working Group and your Policy Advisory Council each passed resolutions calling for the strengthening of this latest proposal on the One Bay Area grant by, number one, allocating funding to the local level based on affordable housing production, and two, that cities should have affordable housing or anti-displacement policies, depending on what's appropriate, from a menu of choices to receive the funding, and really want to encourage MTC and ABAG to reflect this feedback in the next version of the proposal that's released to you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. If there's no further business, this meeting's adjourned.
Mr. Chairman, and then as ABAG, we are, our administrative committee is adjourning but reconvening. So those members on our administrative committee, we have some short business that we need to take care of in Conference Room B.